Okay, let's start with the scenario. A nightmare scenario, really, but one that feels increasingly plausible. The power grid goes down, not for an hour, not for a day, but for a week, maybe longer. The cell towers are dead, the fiber lines are dark. In that environment, what happens to your digital life, your bank account, your ability to send a message to the next town over?
It usually evaporates. We tend to forget that the cloud isn't magic. It's just a computer in a server farm somewhere else.
Somewhere far away.
And if you can't reach that server farm, you don't have a cloud. You have a brick.
Exactly. And that is the terrifyingly practical premise behind the source material we are covering today. We are doing a deep dive into the certified Rios administrator, tracks specifically the new version 2.4 sovereign release.
And to be clear, right off the bat, this isn't your standard corporate IT training. We aren't talking about optimizing Excel spreadsheets or, managing a polite email server.
Yeah.
This is a technical courseware bundle designed to teach you how to operate the IOCC 1000.
Which the documentation explicitly describes, and I love this phrasing because it sounds so military, not as a server, but as a field deployable asset.
That distinction is the whole ballgame.
Yeah.
A server is something you put in a climate-controlled glass room with halon gas fire suppression and a team of guys named Dave monitoring the temperature.
Right.
An asset is something you throw in the back of a truck.
Yeah.
The course is built around the idea of kinetic environments.
Which is a very polite, sterile way of saying when things are exploding, dusty, hot, or underwater.
Pretty much. It's IT training, but it's structured like a survival manual. The mission isn't data storage.
No.
The mission is rebuilding civilization critical infrastructure, communications, finance, record keeping, completely offline.
And the instructor. We have to mention the instructor before we get into the tech.
Remnant.
Right, the AI agent named Remnant. It's not a video of a guy in a polo shirt standing in front of a whiteboard.
No, it's this text-based AI persona that guides you through the labs. It really sets this tone of, okay, the world is broken and we have to fix it.
It does. It keeps you focused on the stakes. But okay, we need to peel back the sci-fi aesthetic because under the hood, this is a very rigorous technical stack.
For sure.
We need to understand how you actually take the internet, put it in a box, and make it bulletproof.
So let's start where the core starts, the hardware.
The body of the beast, the exoshell.
It looks like a Pelican case on steroids. The specs call for an IP67 rated aluminum casing.
Okay, let's pause on IP67. We see that on phones sometimes.
Yeah.
What does it actually mean for a piece of infrastructure like this?
Well, the six is the dust rating. It's completely dust tight, no ingress of dust, complete protection against contact.
Nothing gets in.
And the seven means it can handle temporary immersion in water, up to 1 meter for 30 minutes. But the aluminum choice is more interesting than the waterproofing.
Why is that?
Plastic is waterproof, but they went with aluminum because it acts as a Faraday cage.
So we're talking electromagnetic shielding.
It's exactly. In a disaster scenario or a kinetic environment, you have to worry about RF interference. You might have dirty radio signals or even light EMPs, electromagnetic pulses, depending on the threat model.
Ah, okay.
The shell isolates the sensitive electronics inside from that electronic noise. It effectively creates a silent room for the processors to work in.
Now, looking at the schematics in the virtual teardown module, I noticed something weird. I didn't see any fans on the case, and I'm looking at the specs high performance NVMe blades. Those things get hot.
Very hot.
If I put my laptop in a sealed box, it melts. How does this not melt?
That's the positive pressure cycle.
Which works how?
Traditional servers work by negative pressure. They have fans at the back that suck air in from the front and blow it out the back.
Right, like a vacuum.
And the problem is they also suck in dust, grit, humidity, and sand. If you run a standard Dell server in a desert tent, it'll be dead in a week. It effectively eats itself.
It becomes a vacuum cleaner.
Right. The CC1000 does the opposite. It pushes air out. It creates a high pressure zone inside the case.
Oh, that's clever.
This means that air is constantly trying to escape through the cracks, preventing dust from getting in. It does have intake filters where the air enters, but the maintenance log notes you only need to check them every 30 days, even in heavy dust.
That's amazing. It's breathing out so nothing can force its way in. Okay, so inside the shell, we have the blades.
Four hot swappable NVMe native compute blades. This is the brain. The architecture is clustered.
Meaning they work together?
They act as a single organism. If one blade fails, maybe a capacitor blows or it gets physically smashed, the system instantly rebalances the load to the remaining three.
So you don't lose the whole system.
You don't lose the system, you just lose 25% of your capacity.
Which brings us to the first lab exercise. I found these scenarios really stressful, honestly. They don't hold your hand. This one is called Virtual Teardown, Blade 2 Drive Failure.
This is where the rubber meets the road. The simulation has you replace a physical drive without turning the machine off.
And there is a very specific rule highlighted in red text, the blue light rule.
This is the most common failure point for new admins. You go to the dashboard, you select prepare for removal, but you cannot just yank the drive.
You can't just pull it.
You have to wait for the physical LED on the unit to turn solid blue.
I'll play devil's advocate here. If the drive is dead, why does it matter? Why do I have to wait, just rip it out and put the new one in?
Because dead is relative. The drive might be failing, but the system is still trying to talk to it. The blue light indicates that the data write cache has been fully flushed to the parity drive.
Okay, explain that. What is the parity drive doing?
In a RAID setup redundant array of independent disks, the system keeps a checksum or a mathematical representation of your data on a separate drive. That's parity.
Got it.
If you pull the bad drive, while the system is still trying to save that last bit of data, the cache, you break the mathematical link. You cause corruption. You essentially confuse the system about what was saved and what wasn't.
So patience is actually a technical requirement here. It's not just a suggestion.
Absolutely. If you pull it while the light is blinking, you might corrupt the entire array. You save 3 seconds and lose 3 terabytes.
There was one other warning in the hardware section that felt like something out of a spy movie. The seal integrity light.
Green means stop.
Which is a UI nightmare, by the way. We're conditioned that green usually means go.
In this context, green means safe and sealed. If the light is green, the intrusion detection system is armed.
So if I just pop the latch to look inside because I'm curious.
The system assumes you are an attacker. It assumes you are trying to physically bypass the login screen to steal data. So it triggers a lockdown.
What does a lockdown look like physically? Does it explode?
Thankfully, no. But digitally, yes. It dumps the encryption keys from the RAM.
Oh, wow.
It effectively lobotomizes itself. The data is still on the drives, but it's now encrypted static. Without those keys, it's just random noise.
So you need to go into the software first.
You have to boot into maintenance mode via the software first to tell the machine, hey, it's me, I'm opening the hood.
It's basically a bank vault that melts the key if you touch the handle wrong.
That's the level of security they are aiming for.
Yeah.
If this device falls into enemy hands or just curious hands, the data protects itself.
Okay, so we have this indestructible paranoid box. But a server in a Faraday cage is just a paperweight if it can't talk to anything.
True.
We need to talk about the nervous system, connectivity.
This is the sovereign mesh module. And this is where the Rails philosophy really diverges from standard networking. It operates in a zero trust bubble.
Let's look at the wide area network, the connection to the outside world. The schematics show it relies heavily on Starlink.
It does. Starlink is the primary WAN interface. The logic is simple. Grid independence.
Right.
If the power lines are down, the cable internet is down. If the cell towers are out, LTE is out. Starlink only needs a view of the sky and power.
But the course mentions running Starlink in bypass mode. Why is that necessary? Why not just plug it in like I do at home?
Because you don't want the Starlink router managing your traffic. You want the Rios unit to be the brain. Bypass mode turns the Starlink dish into a dumb pipe. Just a modem.
So Rios takes over everything.
The Rios unit takes over routing, firewalls, and traffic shaping. It gives you control over every packet of data entering or leaving the camp.
It grabs the wheel.
Exactly. It does have a secondary WAN port for LTE or 5G, but the configuration strictly sets that as failover only. It's the backup parachute.
Okay, so that gets us to the internet, if the internet still exists. But what about the local network? The devices right there in the village or the camp. The course talks about a self-healing mesh.
This is beautiful engineering. Think about your home Wi-Fi. You have a router? If that router dies, your phone can't talk to your printer, even if they are 2 feet apart.
The central node is the failure point.
Exactly. It's a hub and spoke model. Break the hub, lose the spokes. In a mesh, every node acts as a repeater. The Rios unit talks to node A, node A talks to node B.
Okay.
If node A fails, the Rios unit automatically reroutes traffic through node C to get to node B. It finds a new path.
Lab exercise 2, the dead zone, really illustrated this for me. The scenario is a storm.
A classic disaster scenario. The storm physically destroys the north node.
So suddenly the clinic, which is the south node, can't talk to the school at the east node.
The chain is broken. They are digitally isolated.
And in a crisis, if the clinic can't request supplies from the school, People could die. The lab forces you to fix this. You can't run a cable through a hurricane.
So what's the solution? The lab suggests a drone.
A mobile Rios repeater. You fly a drone carrying a small repeater node into the physical gap between the clinic and the school.
That's wild, using a drone as a floating patch cable.
As soon as the drone hovers in position, the mesh detects the new node. It bridges the connection through the air. The network heals itself instantly.
And the goal in the lab is to get the latency, the delay back, under 50 milliseconds.
Why 50 milliseconds? Why is that the magic number?
That's the threshold for real-time voice communication.
Mm.
Above 50 mirrors, you get that walkie-talkie delay where people talk over each other. Below 50 mirrors, it feels like a natural conversation.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
In a crisis, clarity is everything. If you're shouting instructions to a medic, you can't have lag.
That's a great point. But the text also mentions client isolation within this mesh. Isn't the whole point to connect everyone? Why isolate them?
You want to connect people, not infections. By default, client X cannot see client Y.
So if I'm on the Wi-Fi and you're on the Wi-Fi, I can't hack your laptop.
Correct. If your phone has malware, it can't move laterally to my device just because we share a network. It's the same protocol they use in hotels or airports.
Smart.
In a disaster, you have to assume some devices are compromised. You don't want a virus sweeping through your refugee camp's network and taking down the clinic and the school simultaneously.
So we have the body, we have the nervous system, now we need the mind, the actual software running on this thing.
Project Phoenix.
The course calls this Project Phoenix.
This is the biggest paradigm shift for the listener.
Hmm.
We are trained, conditioned, really, to think that the cloud is Amazon Web Services or Google Drive.
It's something we rent access to. It's out there.
Right. In the Rios architecture, the cloud is right in front of you. It's running on those NVMe blades we talked about. Project Phoenix is a suite of local-first applications.
Local-first, meaning they work without the internet.
Meaning they live locally. The internet is just a syncing mechanism.
Let's look at the apps. They aren't inventing new things. They're using open-source standards.
Which is smart. You don't want to beta test proprietary software in an emergency.
Yeah.
For communication, it uses Matrix and Element. Think of it like WhatsApp or Slack, but encrypted and hosted on your box.
For storage, it's Nextcloud.
Which is essentially Dropbox or Google Drive, but you own the hard drive.
And the one that surprised me, finance.
Yeah. This is where it gets interesting. It runs a local BTC pay server. This allows the system to run a local Bitcoin and Lightning Network node.
But wait, Bitcoin relies on a global ledger, a blockchain. If the internet is down, how do you trade? Doesn't the whole system stop?
This is the power of the Lightning Network and local ledgers. You can transact locally, I can send you credit, you can pay for food, and the system keeps a local record of those swaps.
Like a tab at a bar.
A cryptographically secure tab. When the internet comes back up, maybe for just 10 minutes a day via that Starlink connection, the system settles those transactions to the global chain.
But in the meantime,
commerce continues. You don't have to resort to bartering chickens.
Lab exercise 3, the village ledger, walks you through this. You use the command line, the Rios CLIA, to set this up.
The command is Rios app deploy BTC pay. It's deceptively simple. You run that, map it to a local address like finance.local, and suddenly an entire community has a banking system that doesn't rely on Wall Street, Visa, or even a continuous internet connection.
You can track trade credits on a tablet entirely offline. That is powerful. But, and here's the skeptical part of me.
Okay.
If you become your own bank and your own telecom, you become a massive target. If I'm a bad guy, I want that box.
You do. You become a high-value asset.
Which leads us to segment 4, the immune system, or as the course calls it, watchtower.
I love the tagline for this module. Firewalls stop IPs. Rios stops physics.
Explain that, because I usually think of security as passwords and firewalls.
Traditional security looks at the digital address,
yeah,
the IP address or the MC address, but those are soft. They can be spoofed.
Right.
I can write a script in 5 seconds that makes my laptop pretend to be your laptop digitally.
So if you ban my IP, I just change it and come back.
Exactly. Rios uses RF fingerprinting.
RF standing for radio frequency.
Right. Every electronic device, your phone, your laptop, has tiny microscopic imperfections in its radio hardware. Maybe the oscillator is 0.001% off, or the amplifier has a specific noise pattern.
Like a vocal cord fingerprint.
Precisely. Even if I change my name tag, my MAC address, my voice, my RF signature, stays the same. The watchtower system listens to the physics of the radio waves coming from the device.
And it sorts these into lists.
3 lists. The green list for known community members, trusted hardware. The gray list for guests. They get internet access but can't touch the local apps like the finance ledger.
Yeah, and the red list.
The hostiles. The devices that are actively attacking the network.
Lab Exercise 4, the intruder, plays this out like a detective story.
The great scenario, you get an alert. High-volume login attempts. Someone is trying to brute force the admin password. They are spoofing their MSI address, so every time you ban the IP, they switch to a new one.
Traditional firewalls would be playing whack-a-mole. You'd never catch them.
They'd be helpless. But Watchtower looks at the signal. You switch to Spectrum View. You physically triangulate the signal source. In the scenario, it's coming from the North Gate.
You find it.
You see the high-power signal.
And then you
just drop the ban hammer.
The command is Riosec Banarf Sig.
And that permanently disassociates that device based on its physical hardware signature. It doesn't matter what IP they switch to. The radio itself is banned.
Wow.
The only way for them to get back in is to physically buy a new device.
It's kicking them out based on the laws of physics. That is incredibly robust.
It has to be. In a sovereign stack, there is no admin at Google to call. You are the only line of defense.
We've covered the hardware, the network, the apps, and the security, but there is one final module. The one that feels the most final. The Black Start.
Disaster recovery.
Mm.
But Black Start is a term usually reserved for restarting power plants after a total grid collapse.
Right.
Using it for IT implies the gravity of the situation.
The scenario here is total collapse. The lights go out, the grid is gone, civilization has essentially crashed.
Yeah.
And you have this box, the IOCC 1000. What do?
You look for the red card. It's a physical laminated checklist attached to the unit with a steel cable.
So you don't have to remember anything.
It's designed for high stress situations where you might be panicked and can't remember the CLI commands.
Okay, let's walk through the procedure. Step one.
Isolate. Disconnect all WAN cables.
Why? If the internet is down, why disconnect the cable?
Because when the grid fails, it often surges before it dies. Or if it's an EMP event, the long cables act as antennas that gather energy. You want to physically disconnect the unit from the outside world to save the electronics from a spike.
Got it. Step two, power.
Verify the generator. The text mentions the AgriDot energy generator, but any generator works. The key is confirming it's stable at 60 hertz.
Why is the frequency so important?
Dirty power that fluctuates between 50 hertz and 70 hertz confuses the power supply units. If the sine wave is jagged, the computer won't boot, or worse, it will fry the motherboard.
You need clean power.
You need clean power before you tune the key.
Step three is the master key.
A special USB drive inserted into port zero. This contains the cold storage encryption unlock key.
And then the reset. You hold the button for 10 seconds.
And this is the part I love. You wait for the audio cue. Computers used to beep at us all the time, and we moved away from that. But in a disaster, you need to hear that it's working. You wait for the heartbeat code.
Three short, one long.
Exactly. Beep, 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 beep. That tells you the kernel is loaded. That's the heartbeat of the system coming back to life.
And once that happens, it broadcasts a specific Wi-Fi signal, OSO's beacon.
And that signals the start of the 15-minute promise.
This is the service-level agreement for the apocalypse.
Ideally, the timeline is strict. Minutes 0 to 5 are for power stabilization. Minutes 5 to 10 are for the boot sequence and file system checks, making sure the data survived the crash.
And minutes 10 to 15.
The mesh broadcast goes live. The applications chat, finance, storage come online.
So, in theory, within 15 minutes of total darkness, a community using this stack has restored their ability to communicate, access their records, and trade goods.
That is the promise. Mm. It turns a catastrophe into a manageable problem. It provides a floor that you can't fall below.
It's impressive, but it also requires a lot of preparation. The courseware actually includes a field kit to help you prepare for this.
It's a 1.2 gigabyte zip file. It's not just PDFs. It has 3D printable parts for the chassis, so if a bracket breaks, you can print a new one. It has full electrical schematics.
And a simulator.
And it even includes a Black Start simulator app that runs in a browser, so you can practice those CLI commands without risking your actual server.
It seems thorough, almost obsessively so.
It has to be. Yeah. If you need this training, you really need it. There's no room for, I think I remember how to do this.
So we've deep dived into the hardware, the mesh, the apps, the security, and the recovery. It's a fascinating look at what sovereign computing actually means. It's not just about privacy. It's about resilience.
It's about ownership.
Mm.
We tend to rent our digital lives. We rent storage from Google. We rent connection from Comcast. We rent financial access from Visa.
Mm.
The Rial stack is about owning the infrastructure. It's harder. It requires maintenance. You have to check the dust filters and watch the blue lights. But it's yours.
And that is the big takeaway for me. We spend our lives relying on the cloud as this infinite, distant resource that will always be there. But if that connection is severed, we realize how fragile that arrangement is.
The cloud evaporates.
Exactly. So I want to leave you with this thought. If the screen goes dark right now, if the fiber line gets cut, do you have a Project Phoenix for your own digital life? Could you rebuild your community's ability to communicate and trade within 15 minutes? Or would you just be in the dark?
That's the question.
Thanks for listening to the Deep Dive. Stay curious and maybe back up your data locally tonight.
Couldn't hurt.